Welcome everyone to this OnFIF podcast with EY on the economic response measures to the COVID crisis. This is John Orchard, CEO of OnFIF, and today we're looking at the impact the crisis is having on governments and their finance ministries, both short and medium term. As the shock and awe measures to rescue economies are set to work, how are they going and what are their consequences? What are the paths out of the emergency schemes? How are governments planning to restart their economies? How will government finances be impacted, and what are the medium-term dependencies that need addressing? How is this crisis fundamentally reordering the priority of finance ministries around the world? Joining me today to talk about this is David Barker at EY, an investment banker by background. David joined EY in 2001, where he was global head of corporate finance for financial services for more than 10 years and was heavily involved in almost all of the sovereign bailouts emerging since the financial crisis. He's worked closely with many governments and supranational institutions over the last decade, and so was asked to lead EY's COVID response across EMEA, addressing the intersection between governments and their ministries of finance with corporations and the public, often through the banking system. You've spoken to a lot of finance ministries over the last 5 or 6 weeks. David, what sort of advice are they looking for from a consultancy firm such as EY?
Well, thank you, John. I think the answer to that is it evolves. We have had a whole range of conversations to deal with the initial shock and what was intended as an awestruck response. Large amounts of money intended to reassure the markets, intended to reassure corporations and employees. And that was initially where people were focused. Have I built the right sort of transmission mechanisms? Are they at scale? Are they working? How do I make them resilient? What is best practice? Particularly, I think, the what is best practice conversation. And having built these mechanisms, I think the conversation has now evolved significantly towards a sort of second layer effect, which is the economics of it all. And in particular, the affordability, which is going to become, as we taper out of some of these programs, is going to become, I think, the next big challenge.
Well, we'll go on to explore all of that. Very important and interesting conversation. We're going to look at the crisis and its responses today through the prism of those conversations you've been having. And we'll break it down to three stages, starting with the shock and awe measures you just mentioned, and then working through their shortened medium-term aftermath and impact. Perhaps you could take us through some of the key initial responses by finance ministries, David, and how they've come about.
Yes, I mean, we spoke an awful lot about, you know, expansionary monetary policy, the impact, if any, of lowering rates, the creation of swap lines. And then I think a lot of conversations about the practical implications of regulatory forbearance, you know, the removal of countercyclical buffers, deferral of stress tests, practical matters like NPL loan recognitions and provisioning. Then we got onto the architecture, and there was quite a series of back and forths with many, many governments about both the direct and through commercial bank sort of fiscal policy interaction. So, you know, as direct measures, we were very much advising around state aid considerations, setting up commercial paper asset purchasing programs through central banks, obviously grants and direct payments. And the biggest focus of all is some kind of the universal basic wage that so many countries have put in place for so-called furloughed workers. What were appropriate previous earning percentages that would be maintained? And I think a lot of those were predicated on expectations of relatively gradual and not too strong a take-up. And I think a number of finance ministers have been really quite surprised by the rate of take-up and the rate of all of this build and the impact it's had on their finances. We've had a lot of conversations about the appropriateness and the structuring of loan guarantees through the banking system, all of it predicated around what is scale. How do I get volumes of money moving forward? Well, this conversation is taking place between you and I in London. I think, you know, in the UK, in the CBILS scheme, there's been well-documented concerns around the ability of CBILS to be deployed at speed. And the new smaller loan scheme, I think, has been much more effective. And volumes in the first couple of days at the time of recording are really quite substantial. I think $1 billion are deployed already in the course of this 1 week. So conversations about the breadth of the pipework and longer term, how we build resiliency.
In the conversations that you've had, you've just mentioned that there's perhaps been a stronger take up than originally anticipated. What have you seen there?
We believe that a number of governments were looking at take up rates of 10-15% over time. And I think real life experience has proven multiples of that, 3 to 4 times that. which is leading to what I would describe as the economic consequences problem of the long-term affordability of furlough schemes. How long governments can continue to plough in, you know, decent percentages of their outstanding debt to GDP into structures that really are probably no more than delaying the inevitable consequence of what has to happen once companies have got through an initial crisis and are forced to stand on their own 2 feet and deal with the world ahead of them, the massively changed world, from their own resources. And I think furlough is merely a mechanism to taper into what for a number of countries will be a severe number of radical restructurings and governments prioritizing amongst industries and sectors. So I think it has been an appropriate buffering, if you like, but an awful lot more now is kind of looming up. It's almost as if the tsunami is drawing back a little bit, the water pulling out, but there's pretty certain next stage of restructurings to come.
Well, we'll come on to that in a moment. You talk about the heavy take-up of the furlough scheme and people starting to consider a path out. What are the immediate challenges that finance ministers are worrying about of that type, whether on implementation or affordability, or in terms of the second order effects on the financial system and the economy as a whole?
Well, I think a number of economies had not restructured their banking systems particularly substantially. I'm not talking about necessarily Western Europe, I'm talking more generally around the world. And there were plenty of legacy non-performing exposures left on balance sheets. Countries had capital raising measures in place for their banks, sale processes, NPL processes. All were disrupted. And an early consideration for governments was around, if I am going to, in theory, avoid moral hazard by requiring the banks to underwrite alongside me on an 80-20, 90-10 sort of relationship, but I'm going to try and put through, you know, maybe 10 or even 12 to 15% of GDP as a stimulus measure into the economy, that is a very sizable amount for a bank to be exposed to if it didn't get into the COVID crisis in good shape. And so I think there is a question about how resilient banks are going to be in some countries. And, you know, again, longer term conversations around asset management companies, so-called bad banks, much rejected by the Eurozone, but are on the minds of a number of countries. So those were some of the early issues about how finance ministries were worrying, I think.
Do you see similarities and differences with the crisis that you helped deal with 10 years ago? You've talked about potentially the health of banks being impacted. They're much better capitalized, as you know, than they were. But what are you seeing in terms of risks there to the financial system?
Well, there's certainly the sovereign banking doom loop, as it used to be called, if I remember correctly. And I think there is a danger that may well reemerge. You know, there's a lot of conversations had about debt sustainability and affordability. And particularly within the Eurozone, you've seen as a number of countries have struggled to be convinced about supranational or commission or IMF agreement on broad platforms of support that are coordinated. Many countries have focused very much on going it for themselves and trying to make their own preparations. And, you know, that's been expressed by a number of people rushing to the Eurobond market to secure cash. And I think crowding out in debt markets is going to be an issue for the future. But I think plenty of conversations around how it is that governments are going to afford to finance all of this. And the other thing, perhaps unrelated to your question, but the other thing we have noticed an awful lot of now is governments trying to avoid the mistakes of the banking crisis and what banks were accused of with the benefit of hindsight, which is, you know, not responding fast enough and perhaps looking after their own positions rather more than societies. Governments from the inception, at least most thoughtful governments, have begun embedding social purpose and good governance and sustainability thinking into their response measures. And, you know, that's all focused around the intelligent, thoughtful and defendable use of taxpayer money. And that will be, as we go into the restructuring phase, I think a particularly important theme for governments to think their way through.
We'll come back to debt sustainability in a moment. It's a key theme and debt affordability. You suggested that there is a risk of over-supporting businesses which came into the crisis or even banks in not particularly good health. How are finance ministries thinking about that and making sure that they don't lumber themselves and their economies with zombie businesses?
Now, I think over-supporting, you say, some transmission mechanisms were incredibly efficient and effective from inception. Plenty of stories about how the Swiss managed to, within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, initiate, set up and deploy a system that you would receive money the same day. And I believe the current small business system in the UK is actually deploying same-day application funding, which is good. But actually, I don't think funding was evenly placed across the size of economies in many instances. You saw a lot of squeezed middles. And we had had conversations with several governments about setting up the equivalent, I suppose, of field hospitals for corporations, how you might bring in a series of distressed and cash flow negative companies, perhaps triage them with super senior cash, evaluate their cash burn for a few weeks, and then find ways of, I suppose, classifying them into relatively easy to resolve complex stakeholder restructurings and those that unfortunately needed to be administered. You know, dealing with panels of lawyers, accountants, bankers to go through complex restructurings and insolvencies. So I didn't think the spread of stimulus was necessarily even across the economy. Generally, the largest corporations through commercial paper through to central banks were well handled. A lot of focus was put on furloughing in the smaller companies. And the middle section, I think, required rather more tinkering with than governments initially thought. And that brings back the role of commercial banks and standing alongside government. So an uneven distribution of stimulus was a first problem. And then, as I say, on to issues of by the time take-up had been witnessed in terms of actual outturn, I think a degree of gulping in a number of finance ministries that this is going to be expensive and it probably can be no more than a buffer, a shock absorber to a day of what some are calling a day of reckoning, where corporations will have to stand on their own 2 feet in a changed world. And that's where focus is going right now.
And we'll come back to that in a moment. I've started to hear the words industrial policy a lot more than you might have heard 10 years ago. Someone, as you've just been suggesting, on the matter of affordability, there seems to be, as you say, a day of reckoning in the post in the sovereign bond markets, perhaps. Some of that can be offset, maybe with monetary financing. That's controversial in its own right. How are finance ministries considering this issue of how they're going to raise this capital and whether it's sustainable and then how to reduce it in the end?
Well, we've noticed a number of conversations have shifted to longer-term philosophical thinking, if you like, around sourcing asset pools to be involved in longer-term financing. We used to talk, I think, of bailing out in the financial crisis, and I think now the conversation is going to move more to bailing in, to find those deep asset pools, be they so-called famed asset pools of private equity, which I suspect are much harder to deploy than governments perhaps understand initially. Pools of insurance capital tied up in very strong balance sheets for a number of insurers and indeed reinsurers. Pools of sovereign wealth fund money, supranational monies, and inevitably things like transaction taxes and asset taxes, wealth taxes, if you like. So there's the beginnings of a philosophical discussion about how to balance and rethink policy, and then a more immediate discussion about, in some smaller countries' cases, you know, a rush to finance, which brings with it, you know, the dangers of issuing government bonds to a banking system and reinforcing a negative loop of sovereign bank dependency. But plenty of people rushing to the bond markets and extraordinary sums of money being talked about. I think it was yesterday in early May at the time of recording when the American administration said in the second quarter, it has a need to finance something approaching $3 trillion, which is, even to my lurid imagination, it's a rather large sum of money. I think the markets will come to focus on gross financing needs, and that is perhaps the appropriate place to think about debt sustainability. I think there are some concerns about longer-term inflationary effects, but broadly, there is an expectation in the new world of close to zero rates for any sensible future planning horizon. And therefore, you can't look at simple debt to GDP measures as a way of figuring out just how sustainable some of these things are. Debt affordability is only part of the picture. I think if you look at gross financing needs and you put a global lens on it, you find countries like the Americans and particularly Italy, which have gross financing needs, I suspect, you know, in the high 20% this year, which is very high, spiky, dangerous territory, and as yet perhaps not reflected fully in government bond spreads. But there are complex and manifold reasons why that wouldn't be the case as yet.
Well, partly central banks are moving heavily the other way for now, although we've seen yesterday that the German Constitutional Court wants to limit that potentially in the case of Europe. So I think a lot of heads being scratched about sovereign financing across the continent. I wanted to explore a little bit more the theme you touched on a moment ago about how finance ministries and governments decide what help to withdraw when. What are the discussions that you're hearing?
Maybe I can divide that into two parts of a question. I described at the beginning how we were talking about a medical vortex and a focus on, you know, reproduction rates. Now I think an economic vortex and a focus on affordability. Governments are at the moment trying to figure out appropriate reopening protocols and restarting protocols. And we've been doing a lot of work for ministries of finance and economy in a number of countries around the likely duration of social distancing as core to everything. And I think a number of governments are taking the view now that without vaccine and mass testing, that there is very little chance of removing social distancing. And so we're entering into conversations with sectors of industry on government behalf. Back to your original question, what do they ask us to do? They ask us to kind of convene, if you like, industry sectors with trade unions, with trade associations, and talk about, you know, burden sharing amongst them in some ways, and reopening protocols. So you can't kind of reopen the oil and gas industry as such, because you may be working on an oil rig offshore, you may be working on a station petrol forecourt, you may be working on the 33rd floor of head office somewhere. So you have to explain to sectors how you have to translate this into environments in which workers find themselves, and then set protocols amenable to everybody to reopen. And a lot of it is around social distancing. So that, I think, is where government thinking is as we speak at the moment. As to timing of which sectors to go, I think countries are having slightly different experiences with medical outturns. And, you know, there's debate around many, many issues, you know, when to reopen, which classes in school. But I think the thing that there seems to be some degree of consensus around is social distancing is here to stay. And that then has implications for things like tourism, hospitality and airlines, perhaps above all else. And countries like, you know, the Philippines and Thailand and closer to Europe, Greece and Portugal, Mexico, maybe, they have close to 20% of their GDP broadly dependent on these sectors. And to the extent those countries are doing furloughing schemes, and the extent to which the UK government, for example, is indicating that social distancing is likely to remain in place until Christmas, perhaps, you are going to have to see a lot of focus on how long those schemes can be maintained for. Just how affordable is that? That's where the conversation is right now.
How are you seeing governments and finance ministries in particular consider the trade-offs and the complicated cost-benefit analyses for preserving social distancing and therefore limiting the health impact versus the considerable impact on the economy?
So there's any amount of work to be done, both by governments themselves and sometimes with the use of advisors, about scenario planning and economic impact assessment by sector. And that is a very interpretive, subjective proposition, I think. And we're debating that with many, many governments. And I think, you know, different governments, as I say, find themselves in very different circumstances. So they are, for many of the more developing economies, have very little capital to spend. And they are going to have to prioritize between not just sectors, but maybe individual companies to support. There are countries that can't afford furloughing at all. We're told furloughing is, or social distancing is something that is a Western luxury to consider. So I think different governments are responding in different ways, but a lot of work, often sponsored by some of the multilateral banks, the development agencies, UNDP, for example, are sponsoring governments working with firms like my own to analyze economic impacts in country by country, sector by sector. But I think there's a lot of debate around which countries will prioritize what at the moment.
We'll certainly come back to the multilateral issue. I think you're describing that the countries that can least afford to deal with the crisis will inevitably have it longer, and consequently it will be more expensive for them. So that's a difficult nut to crack and will require quite a bit of outside help, I think. I wanted to look, before we come on to that, in general, at the day after the day after, so to speak. How are these finance ministries looking to get their economies back as close as possible and as quickly as possible to business as usual? And perhaps more importantly, what problems do they see being left behind that will need medium-term attention?
Well, so I mentioned earlier the idea of creating things such as lender of last resort facilities. And so a lot of work there is, I think, about to come into immediate focus around the restructuring and the cleanup. What, for example, will be the eligibility tests around governments becoming a lender of last resort? You know, prior viability of a company, clearly a major issue, as is, as I mentioned, the public interest and stewardship and governments. Will governments support companies that have foreign shareholders, that have private equity shareholders, that don't pay enough tax in their countries? These are immediate issues that they're beginning to grapple with now. And I think, to your question, in the longer term, there is an amount of reimagining work with some of the strategy consultancies that houses like mine have about what does the future of commercial real estate look like. Talking to banks around Europe, I think a number have found surprisingly easy to work from home. There have been instances, as we know, where middle offices have been impacted by certain locations not having access to laptops in immediate lockdowns. And there is, as there will be in PPE and life sciences, a desire to start reshoring certain core functionalities within industries. But I believe that the experience of COVID actually has a few silver linings to it, perhaps, around many institutions, many sectors being able to be more productive, figuring out in ways that they perhaps didn't need the number and the distribution of people that they have. Perhaps they need fewer retail outlets and clearly more automation around their online and digital offerings. So I think a lot of focus from governments around reimagining city centres. Commercial real estate is one of the core collateral assets of the banking system. How on earth are we going to think about future strategic planning of city centres? What are alternative uses for these sort of things? Many, many issues.
You've described perhaps an interesting further challenge to consider. If businesses that come out of this crisis are more efficient or more productive, perhaps, that may then, of course, lead to less demand for employment. Are you having conversations with finance ministries that are starting to consider these structural issues in the medium term?
Yes, I wish I got some good data, and I don't. I just have anecdotal stories about the rate of acceleration of digitization and automation. But I think it's taken a real leap forward in the last 2 months and plans to continue that at pace. And I think that will necessarily improve productivity, but productivity, as you say, with fewer people. And some of the projections of unemployment rates are pretty startling. I mean, as we know, the Americans have suffered, is it 30 million unemployed in 4 weeks? I think the Bank of Spain in the last 48 hours or so has looked at a worst case unemployment rate of 19%. So with unemployment comes both a loss in revenue and an increase in governmental expenditure. And governments are trying to get their minds around, back to my idea of sectoral impacts, where the unemployment will lie. And they're beginning to think about retraining schemes and pivoting sections of the workforce. A classic example, which UK people often talk about, is, you know, digging and picking agricultural crops. But exactly that same argument I learn applies in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan about how people migrate across borders, some of them to Russia, to pick the agricultural crop, but those borders are now closed and prospectively will likely remain closed. So governments are trying to reimagine the future and rethink pivoting learning, development, training exercises to where they feel there'll be pools of excess labour, and those labour forces need to be redeployed. We've seen a number of airlines around the world encourage their staff on furlough schemes to actively get involved in local social relief programs or in their national health system. So I think there's some very longer term strategic reimagining going on, and governments trying to lock down even the vaguest idea of numbers around it.
Presumably also there is talk of, notwithstanding the fact there is not a lot of money to go around, investment in digital infrastructure, for example.
Yes, exactly so. I mean, I think of things like the Amazon technology to do kind of cashierless shopping, walk in, walk out, and experience the Uber effect of contactless shopping. You can see that being an interesting way of even lowering the physical cost base of city centre retail premises. I think digitisation en masse, but digitisation in a resilient way. And I think resiliency onshore, locally assured resiliency, is going to be another key component part alongside all the other stakeholder value issues, making sure that should lockdowns or future pandemics come back, you can't really rely in the future on just-in-time supply chains anymore. You will at least diversify and have opportunities away from them. Maybe they continue, but alternatives need to be found.
I'd like to go back to explore those countries that take longer to do the things you've been talking about or struggle to do it on their own. Quite a few might need help from multilateral organisations, development banks, and those kinds of intergovernmental institutions. What are you seeing there?
Quite a lot of effort and real speed and progress to try and, perhaps an inappropriate phrase, but push targeted money out of the door at speed. So we've seen, I think it's the, is it the World Bank, isn't it, who have earmarked, I think, $150 billion at the rate of $10 billion or so a month for 15 months to be spent. And the EBRD doing similar things. These are very targeted to help the most disadvantaged in society, to help the smaller micro community SMEs, to help micro lending to them, and often having a prioritized focus around diversity and gender issues within those countries. So trying to pick up the most at-risk elements, I think. And you see the IMF now publicly saying it has over 100 bailout applications. I think, like every other part of operating global infrastructure, there's a need to build scale and resilience into the processing of this. And there is a need to get requests for proposals to countries out at greater speed. So again, firms like mine have been helping draft some of these and working alongside MDBs to try and accelerate what I think was a very good start, actually, for many of them.
Thank you very much, David. That's a very interesting discourse on what's taking place in finance ministries, what they have to address today, tomorrow, and the years and decades to come. Thank you very much for talking to us today.